Okay, so I'm going to talk about basic statistics. And since we have half an hour, I'm going to probably go quickly over some of this. So here's the source for that course, and I encourage you to go look at it. And I've put a summary of it on the wiki, if you're interested. So statistics is a big area, and unfortunately, we have little training in it. We don't study statistics really very much at school. I don't know if you have statistics courses? Well, but is that statistics like I learned, which was mathematics, or is it real statistics related to the real world?
Data analysis,
okay. Okay, so maybe you know more than I do then, and this will go very fast. The thing is that it is difficult to do correct assumptions, and it is easy to make mistakes. So it's tricky because it's an area where intuition is often misleading. So I will talk very briefly about descriptive statistics, which are designed to summarize data, and inferential statistics, which is what we're interested in the experimental approach, where we try to generalize data about the sample to the population from which the sample comes from. So, when we talk about statistics, we talk about statistical variables, and there are different types of variables. So, I will talk about three main types. Nominal variables are variables that can have a set of values, but there is no order between those values. So the sex, male or female, the type of input device, you're using a mouse or a trackball or joystick, there is no order. So the type of things we do with those nominal variables is we typically want to count the occurrences and then compare these. Then there's ordinal variables, where it's a set of values, and this time there is a natural order, but they're not on a scale. So if I ask you your preference for something, and I ask you to grade it between 0 and 5, or if I give you a grade on your exam between A and F, even though it is very tempting, there is no notion that the distance between 0 and 1 is the same between 1 and 2, or the distance between B and C is the same between C and D, right?
No real scale.
There is no scale. When there is a scale, you get a scalar value, variable. And here it's an ordered set of values on the scale, a numerical scale. And you have two types of scales, those that are zero-based and those that aren't. So, for example, temperature, you cannot say that 40 degrees is twice as hot as 20 degrees. The zero is arbitrary in the temperature, right? But if you measure something, you can say something is twice as big as something else, because 0 centimeters means something. So, scalar variables are ordered values on a scale. I can compare differences. And if there's a real zero, then I can also make other computations. So typically for us, time is a good scalar variable, speed, distance. So when we deal with independent factors in our experiments, they are oftentimes nominal. What type of techniques I'm testing? Radial versus a linear menu, subject expertise, things like this. Sometimes our independent variables are scalar, like the number of items or the size of the menu, or the index of difficulty, which is expressed in bits. It's just less frequent, and oftentimes the independent variables are nominal. On the other hand, the dependent variables are often scalar, often measure the time it takes to execute a task, the frequency of actions, the number of errors. I can can say you made twice as many errors in that condition and in that condition. And we deal with ordinal variables when we do questionnaires. Oftentimes after an experiment, if we've compared two techniques, we'll do a questionnaire saying which one did you prefer, which one felt faster, which one is more comfortable. And we ask people to rank this between, you know, 0 and 5 or something like this. And so these are ordinal values, and we use different tests for those. So very quickly, descriptive statistics are designed to summarize a set of measures or a variable. And so, you know, if I have here the example is a set of exam scores, one thing I can look at is a distribution of these values. And then I can look at this distribution and look at ways to characterize this distribution. So there are different types of distributions and different measures of central tendency, like the mean, variability, how spread it is, and measure of correlations between variables. So typically, we often deal with distributions where there is a spread of values around a more central value. Again, these are distributions of values. We can see here various types of distributions, ones at the top that are more or less skewed to the right or to the left, meaning they're not symmetric. At the bottom we see that they are more or less spread. So I have a peak, but it's much bigger in the section E, much higher, so it's more centered around this. And then I have distributions that have multiple peaks, and these are called multimodal. Here it's bimodal. Typically, it's frequent when you do exam scores that you have those who did bad and those who did well, and then there's something in between, but you often have these two peaks. So the idea with measures of central tendencies and measures of variability is to try to summarize these types of curves in a few numbers. So we have the mean. You know what the mean is, to explain to you. Do you know the median? Okay, you take all the values ordered and you look at the middle one. And the mode is the most frequent value. And if you have a non-skewed distribution, the mean is going to be equal to the median. If the distribution is skewed, which is more heavy on one side or the other, the mean and the median are going to be different. If you have several peaks in the distribution, you will have several modes, and you can describe this as well. Now, to measure the variability of the distribution, we look at the spread. One way is the interval, distance between minimal and maximal values. But that's not very good because we can have what's called outliers. One value that is very low or very high, completely sort of outside the range, and so that sort of affects the interval. So a better measure is the variance in standard deviation that looks at sort of the average distance to the mean. And one thing that is often done in statistical analysis is to scale things by the standard deviation. Coming back to the outliers, if you measure the standard deviation or the variance, you can have a criterion to say everything that is more than 2-3 standard deviations away from the mean, I will consider an outlier. It is just something abnormal. Maybe the user, you know, stopped and went to have a drink, or the system broke, or something happened, and I ignore these. Finally, on this quick section on descriptive statistics, the notion of correlation between two variables. So this is something that we often want to do in statistical analysis, whether two variables are correlated, And usually what you do is you draw the graph as we see at the bottom, the x versus y. And if the points more or less are grouped and aligned, then it looks like there is a correlation. So there is the measure called the R-square of the linear correlation between two variables. The formula is here, doesn't matter. All you need to know is that if it's zero, it means what? Is the R-square is zero. So zero means correlation or no correlation?
No correlation.
No correlation. Right. If you have a cloud of points, correlation is zero. If the correlation goes towards plus one, it means they're positively correlated, so they grow together. And if it's more like minus one, it's what's called a negative correlation. It means that one decreases when the other increases. So be careful that correlation doesn't mean cause. And we've talked about this already, so I'll get back to it. So these were just the little bits of descriptive statistics that I needed to introduce the inferential statistics, which is really what I'm interested in. So the fundamental question we have is the statistical significance of the results that we measure in an experiment, and we measure these on a sample of a population, and if we observe a difference between two conditions, say linear menus versus radial menus, or if we observe a correlation, say, between the movement time and the index of difficulty, can we generalize that result to the full population? If I take just three subjects, intuitively, you know, I will have quite a bit of variability. If I take ten subjects, the results are more reliable. So the more subjects, the bigger my sample, the more likely I have to have these significant results that I am confident to generalize to the population. That is assuming that my sample of subjects is also random in the population. If I only take, you know, the very best at doing some task, it will not be representative. So to explain this thing that the significance depends, among other things, but crucially on the number, on the size of the sample, imagine that you have two dice, and you roll the dice 10 times. So the two dice are in principle independent, right? So if I look at the correlation between the values x and y of the two dice in each of the throw, I expect the correlation coefficient to be close to zero. There shouldn't be correlation. Now, if you calculate this with probability theories, you know, each dice has a chance in six to come out for each value, so you can apply all the formulas I've shown before to this. Well, you'll find that there is 12% correlation, so 0.12, no, sorry. You will have a coefficient of correlation that is larger than 0.5, 12% of the time when you throw 10 dice. I mean, I don't know for you, but it seems counterintuitive. Now, if you throw the dice 30 times, this probability will go down to 0.5%, so very, very unlikely. So going from a sample of 10 to a sample of 30 changes the curve to what we see on the left, pretty flat. the parts that are on the right and on the left here, 6 plus 6%. So you see how to read that? I throw the dice 10 times, I compute the R, and I plot how many times the R is going to be 0 or in each of these slots. And so the two tails here tell me overall how many times the R's are going to be more than 0.5 or less than minus 0.5. If I go to 30 samples, the same curve there becomes a lot, you know, more centered, and the two tails now are 0.25% each. So if I have a real phenomenon, I'm more likely to see it in the sample if the sample gets bigger. Now what we're interested in is how small can the sample be so I don't have to test hundreds of subjects when I want to do an experiment. So statistical tests determine the probability that the correlation or an observed difference in the sample is the result of chance. So in other words, all these tests are based on the same idea. I set a confidence level, generally 5% for us. If you're in the medical sciences, maybe it's more than like 1% because you don't want to kill people too often. And so the question you're asking is, if the observed phenomenon had fewer than 5% chance to happen just by chance, by throwing the dice, then we say that the observed result is significant for this confidence level. And the tests we're making are valid if some hypothesis about the sample and the population are valid. So you understand that what we're doing here is playing with probabilities. We have a phenomenon. We are drawing subjects from a general population. And we're testing this phenomenon on this sample of subjects. And so if we assume a certain distribution of the phenomenon in the population, we want to see if we observe a similar distribution in the sample. But in fact, we cannot observe the full population. So what we're asking instead is, given what I observe in the sample, how likely it is that it is also true in the population. So if you remember for my dice experiment here, I was looking at the two tails of the distribution. I was looking at the positive correlation as well as the negative correlation. Well, when you run experiments, sometimes you ask a non-directional hypothesis. There is a difference. I don't know what it is, but there is a difference. Somewhat more often, you're having a directional hypothesis. Not only I think there is a difference, but I think my radial menu should be faster than the linear ones. So you're not just saying there is a difference between my two types of menus. I make a hypothesis about which direction that is. And so that means that if you look at the distributions that we were talking about, in one case, you want to look at the chances that you are on either side of the tail, because you don't know which difference you're interested in. But in a directional case, you're only interested in one tail. And as you can see, you're more likely to get significant results if you have a directional hypothesis than a non-directional one, because you're only looking at one tail. Okay, so now we look at the actual test that we use, depending on the kind of things we're trying to test. So if you look at correlation, which was the case for the ID versus movement time, we assess the statistical significance of a correlation between two scalar variables. So the idea is that if the correlation is zero in the population, meaning there is no effect, what is the probability that when I pick a sample of size n, I observe a correlation of r? which is exactly my example with the dice. I know that if I throw the dice a million times, I will see no correlation. But it so happens that if I take a sample of 10, there's a 12% chance that I'm getting more than 0.5. So, opposite question, I throw 10, I see a certain R, what does it mean about the general population? So here we're not interested we're interested in a significance level of 95%, or a P of 5%. So given a sample of size n, what is the minimal value of the coefficient of correlation for it to be significant? And so the graph on the right here typically shows what happens for non-directional or directional hypotheses. So you'll see that if I observe a coefficient of correlation of 0.5 with a directional hypothesis, n has to be at least, say, 11 for this to not be just by chance. If I observe a coefficient of correlation of 0.3, which is less, I need to have an n of at least 30 for a directional hypothesis. If I observe a very strong coefficient, 0.8 or 0.9, when we do Fisk-Law experiment, typically we get at least 0.9, 0.95, etc. So I can do this with a very small sample size of 5 or 6. Okay?
Sorry.
Yes?
For the Pearson test, is it the curve? Is it something given? Or you have to compute it every time? Or is it for this particular experiment?
No, this is... this is general for the 95% confidence level.
Okay. Okay, good.
Right. And I mean, it's very intuitive that if you have a very strong correlation, you need a smaller sample size, and that's sort of independent of what it is you're measuring. Okay, so the next test I'm going to talk about quickly is the chi-square. Very well-known test. So this is used when you count the number of occurrences in nominal categories. So typically you ask users, which is your preferred technique? And the chi-square can be used when you have multiple dimensions. So you can count the number of users who say they prefer a given type of menu. That's one dimension. Who prefer a given type of menu, and then you look at them per expertise level. So you look at what's the preference for experts, intermediate users, and novices. And then maybe you run the experiment using different devices, like a mouse versus joystick or a trackpad, and so you can look at how many prefer a particular technique given their expertise and given a particular input device. And again, the chi-square does a similar thing as the Pearson test, which is to tell you if the difference that you observe is statistically significant, and so whether it would apply for the overall population. I don't have a graph here because it's a bit more complicated to put into graphs. Also, it turns out we don't do chi-square tests that often in HCI experiments. So I'll spend a little bit more time on the things we do more often, which is to compare the means. So we timed users doing linear menus and those doing radial menus, and we look at the average of those means for these two subgroups, and we observe a difference. Well, how can we trust that this is real? So here we're comparing two means, and the question is to decide whether this observed difference is could be the result of chance. Now, for being able to apply the test, there are some hypotheses that you must make about the population and about the sample. And most often, these hypotheses come around the notion of a normal distribution. So you know, you all know the bell curve of a normal distribution. So you're assuming that if I take the whole population and I ask you to select an item in the menu, I will have a normal distribution around the central value. And the same population, if I do it for the other type of menu, I will have a normal distribution. And the test, of course, you can never verify that this occurs, but it's a hypothesis. So a normal distribution appears each time there is a purely probabilistic variability around a mean value. And again, if you take a random process like throwing a coin, if I throw a coin 20 times, well, I may get 10 heads and 10 tails. But if you look at this curve, chances are I can, you know, there's a significant chance that I could get 5 of one and 15 of the other. So this is the bell curve from this binary random process. And the more trials you get, and the more you approach the theoretical distribution. So when you start to compare means, the easiest situation is you compare the means between two samples. So I have these two samples of these two population, two population testing the two different types of menus. I want to compare those means. So, oh, why am I not in the full slide here? Sorry. Why is PowerPoint?
I think you have to press the down button.
Left,
in the left corner.
Oh, this one is better? Oh, thank you. I mean, why would you use the big normal icon, and why would this one work differently? Well, I learned something, thank you. So, so in the student's test, t-test, you have two versions of it, depending on whether the samples are correlated or non-correlated. Which gets us back to this between subjects versus within subjects. If I take half the room to do the radial menus, the other half to do the linear menus, I take two subsamples of the population. They are non-correlated. And so I cannot take advantage of the fact that in the other case, the correlated case, the same subject is doing the two tasks. So I cannot take into account the intergroup correlation. So the tests are different, and it will tend to be more sensitive when the samples are correlated, because the same subject is doing the two tests, I mean the two trials, the two conditions, sorry. And so if I observe differences, they're more valuable than if I have you do radial and you do linear, because I don't know anything about your overall performance, right? So if you compare things within subjects, you get usually stronger results. Now remember that you also get other problems like learning and other things. So, you know, it's not that simple. But in terms of the statistical test, it's better to have correlated samples and therefore within subject designs. Now, if you compare, if instead of two menus, I had three types of menus, so I have the linear, I have the radial, and I don't know, I have the third type of menu, maybe
Markov.
I'm sorry?
The Markov one?
The marking menu where the menus appear, or maybe something completely different where I have a keyboard shortcut, for example. Anyway, if I were to compare more than two means, then I cannot do multiple t-tests. And there are still many people who do this, but you can't. So you will get incorrect results because essentially you are reusing the same information. So it just doesn't work. So the thing you use for this is called an ANOVA, analysis of variance. And what the ANOVA does is what the t-test doesn't do is to separate the internal variability of each sample from the between sample variability. And that's the key of the analysis of variance. The other thing is the ANOVA is a very robust test. And what robust means is that even if the hypothesis are not completely satisfied, in particular the normality hypothesis, the results are reliable. You can trust the results. Okay. This is particularly true if the samples are not of identical sizes, but the ANOVA is also robust to samples of different sizes. And again, this is important because when we run an experiment, we design it to have what we call the cells, each conditions have the same number of samples, so we design it to have samples of same size. But first, we have outliers. Sometimes we find, you know, trials that were completely off the charts, and so we got rid of those. Second, sometimes we want to eliminate the samples that led to a miss, like, you know, the pointing ones, because we don't want to account for the extra cost of pointing outside the target. So in practice, we often end up with samples of different sizes. So what is very good about the ANOVA, it is robust to a number of these assumptions. Now, the thing is, the ANOVA only tells you, yes, there is a difference, and yes, you can trust it. But it doesn't tell you anything more. It doesn't tell you whether the difference between A and B is significant, or B and C, or A and C, or all three of them. For this, you have what are called post hoc tests, and the most well-known one is Tukey's HSD test. I think it means highly significant. I don't know what it means. So Tukey's test. Once you have an ANOVA that gives you a significant result, you can run the Tukey's test, and it's a pairwise test. It will tell you A and B, is the difference significant? Yes, no. B and C, is it significant? Yes, no. A and C, is it significant? Yes, no. And oftentimes you will find that some are and some aren't. The final thing about the ANOVA is that it can also measure interactions between factors. So if I'm using two factors, like number of items in the menu and type of menu, I can see if there is an interaction that is maybe for small menus, the difference between radial and linear is big. And as the menus get bigger, maybe the difference gets smaller. Or maybe it's the opposite. I don't know exactly what it is. But you get these interaction graphs where it shows you how a difference changes according to the another variable. And if you have two variables, you can have simple interaction effects. If you have three variables, you have interaction effects between more than two variables, and it gets very difficult to explain. So one reason to get simple designs, not having more than two, at max three factors, it's not only that it simplifies things, so fewer subjects, fewer shorter experiments, simpler designs and all that. But it also means that when comes the time to analyze the data, it is simpler to analyze. Because the more factors you have, the more interaction you will have, and you will not understand what is going on. So your effects are likely to become barely significant because you've added too much stuff. So another reason for reducing the number of factors is to make simple analysis, especially ANOVA with simple interaction effects is usually all that you need. So to wrap up, for our experiments, we wanted to, what are we going to test? First, look at the quality of the data you've collected. If you've made an assumption that the selection times, or the pointing times, follow normal distributions, check that it is indeed the case. Invalidate the null hypothesis, so make the proper test depending on your type of variable and the number of variables and all these things. So students test, ANOVA, Pearson, whatever, that you get some significant result. Here, we are probably going to do a t-test to compare the means between the two types of menu. But if you want to compare the performance by expertise level, we need to go to an ANOVA. Once you've tested your main hypothesis, usually you want to test secondary hypothesis. One of the secondary hypotheses we had was, as the menu gets bigger, this or that is happening. So correlations between selection times and menu size or even item number. So in fact, this comparison between linear and radial menu, someone did it quite a while ago, the Chi conference in 1988. And here's the data that they published. They call them Pi menus instead of radial menus. And they show you the target times. So Pi menu, what is that? Why is it using Pi menu linear? Okay, let's forget about those tables and look at the data here. This was a graph. I'm sorry, I copied that and it's not what I thought it was. So I'll have to to look at it in more detail. But here, what you have is the target location and the seek time, the time it takes to get to the target. And what you see overall is, with the linear menu, you see that it gets larger and larger. You know, I'm not sure a histogram was the best way to do this here, I would have done a plot. But you see that those bars get higher and higher. If you look at the Pi menu, interestingly, you have two low ones, number 1 and number 5, which I would bet are left and right or up and down. And then the other ones are sort of similar. We don't see a trend that it's really going up with item number. And if you look here, this is number of errors. We see that that is interesting. The number of errors was really large for linear menu with target location 5. I'm not sure I understand why is that. But overall, we can see the trend here that the errors for Pi menus were way lower and very low for some of the items. I thought the tables here were the main results for the main hypothesis, but I'm not sure why they're crossing the things in this way. So maybe I didn't copy the right charts from the table. One thing I will try to do next time is to show you quickly how to do an analysis with real data and an analysis tools rather than showing these results. This is another result for a pointing experiment that we did. It was not a traditional pointing experiment. It was a pointing experiment where the user could zoom in and out. So the targets could be very, very small and very, very far, but through zooming you could approach the target. And we showed that it was still following Fitts' law, even though it was not the traditional pointing tasks. And so this is a correlation plot that we get. So this is the various IDs that we tested up to 30. And this is the movement times that we get. This is the spread of the dots around each value. We didn't put all the data, but just the mean and the standard deviation around it. And if you do the regression line, you get correlation coefficient of 0.995, which is extremely convincing. Okay, and as I said, you need to be careful when you interpret the results. Significance is not important. You get a significant result, you need to look at the size of the effect. And the p-value does not tell you the effect size. When you do statistics, I'll try to show you next time, it gives you this p-value, the confidence you have in the result. And oftentimes people say, oh, it's very significant, so I have this big effect. No, you get an effect that you can sure exists, but the size of the effect is different. It's important to check that the assumptions are properly verified, like normal distributions. For example, when you measure time, because time cannot be negative, you don't get the regular normal distribution. You get a skewed distribution. So there are ways to transform the data. A number of people, for example, apply a log transform to time, so it turns into a more normal distribution. And when you log transform, of course, it changes the values, and so some things may become significant or not significant. And usually the more you start transforming the data, the more it becomes black magic, so I don't like that very much. And remember that all your tests are done at 95% confidence, so there's one chance in 20 that you may get magnificent results, but it was just by chance. statistically, there are 5% of the results published in the literature that are non-results, because it was just the results of chance. So replicate when you can. Okay, so in summary, we've seen how to conduct a controlled experiment, from deciding what variables to use to running tests and interpreting the results. Still have to be careful. There are experimental effects due to experimental conditions. The placebo effect is the well-known one. I mean, the placebo effect exists. It's been proved to exist. So I don't know that there is placebo effect when you compare menus and things like this. But there are certainly effects that are due to experimental conditions. And so always be very careful when you analyze the results and not overgeneralize. Okay, that's it for today.